Good morning. My name is Andy Pollock. I'm a member of the congregation, and there's a tradition in this church of members of the congregation taking the service from time to time. It's a bit more than from time to time at the moment because we're in between ministers, so today it's my turn. I'm going to light the chalice with the words of the great scientist and philanthropist Albert Schweitzer. As at times our own light goes out and is rekindled by a spark from another person, each of us has cause to think with deep gratitude of those who have lighted the flame within us. So the first hymn is hymn 55, Dark of Winter. It's not very dark today, but it is winter. This is the membership service, so I think Dennis is going to take over for me for a bit here.
Double act. Good morning, everyone, and welcome. And just to say that this is a sort of formal service of membership, where people can come to this church, not be a member, and feel equally at home here. It's just a more formal first step to how we organise ourselves as a community. And we don't have a creed, but we have these lovely words that we use to express our aims. And maybe everybody could join in saying this that are in the back of the book. Love is the doctrine of this church. The quest for truth is its sacrament, and service is its prayer. To dwell together in peace, to seek knowledge in freedom, to serve humankind in fellowship, to the end that all souls shall grow in harmony with the divine. Thus do we covenant with each other and with God. This morning, 11 new members are going to be welcomed into the fellowship of our church. These are men and women who find themselves in agreement with our purposes and who are willing to support us in our activities. So I'm going to invite the 11 people to come forward if you are here to sign our book. I call these imposters because they're people who've been coming to this church for longer than I have, some of them. Some of them have taken services and everything, but we couldn't find their names in the membership book. So it could very well be a formality. Chair.
Some of these members, may I say, have been coming for a very long time. Unitarianism is a movement fundamentally characterized by its steadfast devotion to three leading principles. First, complete mental freedom in religion rather than bondage to creeds and confessions. Second, the unrestricted use of reason in religion rather than reliance upon external authority or past tradition. Third, generous tolerance of differing religious views and usages rather than insistence upon uniformity in doctrine, worship, or polity. Freedom, reason, and tolerance, it is these conditions above all others that this movement has from the beginning sought to promote. It's not difficult to join this church. One signs the membership book, and the material rewards are few, if any. In fact, your act of membership will probably bring you, and most likely already has brought you, more requests for service and support than it will be the cause for rewards and statements of appreciation. Above all else, we ask that you make to this community a very precious gift, the gift of your individual ideas and your sensitive ideals. I charge you in your act of membership to share with us your creative thoughts, your vital experiences of life, your questions, your doubts, and your discoveries of all the ways in which life affects you and those people and principles that matter most to you. I welcome you to the Dublin Unitarian Church, to its idealism and its freedom, to the depth of its inheritance and the breadth of its fellowship, to the faith and hope and love which bring us together, to all the service of every sort which this church can render to you and yours, and to the giving of yourselves in service to others in and through this church.
The first reading is from Trish.
How do I follow all that, Joanna? This reading is from a woman who was called a Christian mummy blogger in the States. Her name was Rachel Held Evans. And this was written in 2017. Her first child was born in 2016. It's a long reading, so I'm giving a bit of an abridged version of it today. I just thought that it might just matter around this time again. The first part of it is about her birth, the birth and all the rest of it, and she starts with, "I knew I would love this little boy, of course, but I had no idea how much I would like him. Somewhere between our baby's first laugh and his first clumsy crawl, Trump won the nomination. Just a few days before our baby's first steps, Trump won the presidency, November 2016. Oh, it was the hardest year on my marriage for sure, and on my body, my faith, and my ongoing battle against cynicism. But there is no doubt in my mind that 2016 will always be remembered as his year, the one that brought the world. His first yawn, his first giggle, his first fall, his first Christmas, his first word. For me, the dissonance of this strange year is compounded by the fact that motherhood turned my bleeding heart into a hemorrhage. It's as though I've become porous, my skin absorbing the pain of others, particularly other mothers and babies. Every night as I nurse my boy in that cozy armchair in his nursery, I think of the Syrian mother nursing her baby in a raft adrift on the Mediterranean Sea. I think of the shell-shocked boy from Aleppo. I think of how every Latino kid taunted by classmates, every soldier sent to war, every autistic kid who may lose his therapy, every black man shot by police is somebody else's baby boy, somebody else's most important person in the world. I still, almost every day, think of Sandy Hook. Compassion is the sometimes fatal capacity for feeling what it is like to live inside somebody else's skin, writes Frederick Buchner. It's the knowledge that there can never really be any peace and joy for me until there is peace and joy finally for you too. Motherhood invited me into other people's skin in a way I've never experienced before, so my joy is big and real and consuming and also incomplete. I am overwhelmed by the conviction that every mother should be able to feed her baby like this in safety and contentedness, and I am haunted by the reality that this is still far from the case. In 2016, I became aware more than ever of the darkness around us and more invested than ever in lighting the path. In 2016, the world bared its teeth and my baby giggled back. Blessedly, in the aftermath of the election, I had the occasion to revisit Madeleine L'Engle's fantastic Genesis trilogy, as I had been asked to write a foreword for the new edition. One thing that struck me while rereading the series was how forthcoming L'Engle was about her own fears around raising children during the Cold War. Planting onions that spring was an act of faith in the future, she writes, for I was very fearful for our planet. If I affirm that the universe was created by a power of love, she continues, and that all creation is good, I am not proclaiming safety. Safety was never part of the promise. Creativity, yes. Safety, no. All creativity is dangerous. To write a story or paint a picture is to risk failure. To love someone is to risk that you may not be loved in return, or that love will die. But love is worth that risk, and so is birth, its fulfillment. She refers, of course, to her famous Advent poem, which begins, "This is no time for a child to be born, with the earth betrayed by war and hate, and a comet slashing the sky to warn that time runs out and the sun burns late." And it concludes, "When is the time for love to be born? The inn is full on the planet Earth, and by a comet the sky is torn, yet love still takes the risk of birth." This was a strange year to have a baby. Perhaps for you it was a strange year to lose a father, to be ordained, to become a citizen. But if the incarnation has anything to say about it, we don't get to wait around for ideal circumstances to begin creating, birthing, nurturing, planting, protesting, and working together to heal the world. So my prayer for you today and in the days, weeks, and months ahead is this: no matter what it means to you, take the risk of birth. Don't be afraid. Finish the book. Pursue the relationship. Begin the ministry. Push the boundaries. Join the march. Write the screenplay. Do the dishes. Plant the onions. Carry the child. Roll around on the floor with your giggling toddler as if the world was even fractionally worthy of his presence. I'm so glad I did. Rachel Held Evans died in 2019 following a short illness, leaving behind a three-year-old and a one-year-old child. And her blog is still available for anybody to read.
I have the second hymn, which is hymn 88, "Calm Soul of All Things." This, my reading, was written or was read originally in 2019. Martin Luther King Jr. would have turned 90 this year. While his name and his contribution to the US civil rights movement are revered, some wonder if King's legacy is in jeopardy amid a resurgence of racism, xenophobia, and hate crimes in the United States. Moreover, while the African American church was the foundation for King's activism and organizing, many progressives and anti-racists see faith as an obstacle to racial justice, pointing to the conduct of some white evangelical Christians in recent years. Harvard Divinity School visiting scholar Cornell William Brooks pushes back both on the doubts about King's legacy and reports of the decline in the importance of religious communities in social justice movements. This former president of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People and an ordained minister in the African Methodist Episcopal Church says that people of faith have a commitment and willingness to sacrifice that is crucial, critical for successful activists. And he says that the legacy of Martin Luther King ought to be measured not in the persistence of racism, but in the combination of hope and realism that he brought to the struggle for the rights of marginalized people everywhere. Polling data indicate that most Americans believe that President Trump's words and actions encourage white supremacy. Recent research links racist and sexist attitudes with the way that many white voters cast their ballots in 2016. Remember, this is 2019. And earlier this month, a prominent member of Congress wondered aloud to the New York Times, "White nationalists, white supremacists, Western civilization, how did that language become offensive? Does this represent a resurgence of racism more than 50 years after some of the most important victories of the civil rights movement? Would Dr. King be discouraged? How might he respond?" Cornell William Brooks says, "I don't believe that he would be shocked and surprised that in 2019 we have a congressional representative clinging to the vestiges of white supremacy under the guise of Western civilization. Dr. King understood profoundly the degree to which racism, xenophobia, bias, and bigotry are deeply entrenched in the American psyche. That said, he might be disappointed at the degree to which we have apologists for racism in our society. In the mountaintop speech in Memphis, just before his assassination, Dr. King noted the enduring moral agency of his people. The sermon was a hopeful proclamation of the life that he expected us to live in the future, that, quote, we as people will get to the promised land. He reminded us that hope is not empirically demonstrated, it's morally chosen. We choose to believe that which scripture, our tradition, our history as God's people says about us and what it says about our future. And in the same way that he hoped, we yet hope. I yet hope. I'm going to have a couple of reflections from an American poet, Dennis Levertov, an American Catholic activist, Dorothy Day, followed by the prayer that Jesus taught us. This piece from Denise Levertov is number 648 in your hymn books, and if you could say the words in italics, and I'd say the words in Roman lettering. 648, beginners. But we have only begun to love the earth. We have only begun to imagine the fullness of life. How could we tire of hope? So much is in the bud. How can desire fail? We have only begun to imagine justice and mercy. Surely our river cannot already be hastening into the sea of non-being. Not yet, not yet. There is too much broken that must be mended. We have only begun to know the power that is in us if we would join our solitudes in the communion of struggle. And from Dorothy Day, people say, what is the sense of our small effort? They cannot see that we must lay one brick at a time, take one step at a time. A pebble cast into a pond causes ripples that spread in all directions. Each one of our thoughts, words, and deeds is like that. No one has a right to sit down and feel hopeless. There is too much work to do. And the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory. What I'm going to say is based on an address I gave in the church 22 years ago. So apologize to those older members of the congregation who may have heard a version of this before. Hope in a hope-challenged world. We are living in a frightening world these days. The second coming of the megalomaniac Donald Trump to the American presidency, the genocidal war of Israel in Gaza, the grinding brutal war in Ukraine, continuing bloody civil wars in Sudan and Syria, the rise of the far right in previously stable European democracies like France, Germany, Italy, and the Netherlands, and above all, the failure of our leaders to grasp the greatest challenge of modern times, how to tackle catastrophic climate change. Contemplating any one of these huge challenges would make an ordinary person feel hopeless. let alone all of them together. But it is precisely at times like these that we most need hope. As Seamus Heaney said almost exactly 30 years ago, quoting the Czech president, playwright, philosopher, and dissident Václav Havel, "Hope is a state of the soul rather than a response to the evidence. It is not the expectation that things will turn out successfully, but the conviction that something is worth working for, however it turns out. Its deepest roots are in the transcendental, beyond the horizon." Of course, hope is not only something needed by people in societies full of violence and injustice. To have hope in the future is absolutely essential for all human existence. Without it, we would have nothing to look forward to except suffering and death. Sometimes when I'm sitting on the bus or walking down the street, I look at the faces of all the scores and hundreds of people around me and wonder, what are their problems and worries? What keeps them going through difficult times? What hope or joy or love, or perhaps hope of joy and love, do they have in their lives which sustains them? I'm not going to talk about the Christian teaching on hope. I know that in the past 60 years or so, this has moved beyond the barren doctrine of the last things, the events which traditional Christians believe will break upon humankind and the world at the day of judgment and the return of Christ. Christians are now divided, as they are on so many things, when it comes to answering the question, what can we hope for? The American theologian Michael Scanlon says traditional Christians answer eternal death, eternal life after death for the purified soul. Liberal Christians say, yes, ultimately eternal life, but penultimately a more just, a more peaceful order. I will be talking more about hope in this world rather than hope in the world to come, which is something that as a doubting Unitarian, I have real problems with. Although I believe with Heaney and Havel that the virtue of hope in this world is rooted in something transcendental, that is, not of this world. I'd like to look very briefly at the two linked elements of hope that Václav Havel says are fundamental, that hope is a state of soul rather than a response to the evidence, and it is not the expectation that things will turn out successfully, but the conviction that something is worth working for, however it turns out. And I'm going to cite philosophers and political thinkers rather than theologians for these propositions. Soul is a difficult concept, especially for us rationalist Unitarians. The soul is that part of a person which drives her or him to search for a deeper meaning to life, something beyond the immediate and the material, something transcendental which, if we glimpse or feel or experience it, however momentarily, it will make our lives richer, more meaningful, more worthwhile. Acts of human love, human goodness, and solidarity with our suffering fellow human beings are clearly ways in which one can glimpse the soul. It is in this sense that I believe Havel is using the term soul. And again, as Havel points out, one does not have to be religious to glimpse the soul. The former Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, has written about the 9/11 attacks on New York and Washington by Al-Qaeda. He was in New York at the time. About the frightening contrast between the, what he calls, murderously spiritual, the Muslim fanatics piloting the planes of death, and the compassionately secular. By the latter, he meant the mobile phone messages sent by passengers on the doomed planes to their spouses and families in those desperate last minutes. He writes, "Someone who is about to die in terrible anguish makes room in their mind for someone else, for the grief and terror of someone they love. They do what they can to take some atom of that pain away from the other by the inarticulate message on the mobile. That moment of making room is what I, as a religious person, have to notice. that secular making room for love could also be characterized as making room for the soul at the point of death. In his essay, The Politics of Hope, Václav Havel writes, "I should probably say first that the kind of hope I often think about, especially in situations that are particularly hopeless, such as prison," and remember that Havel spent several years in prison under the communists, "I understand it above all as a state of mind, not a state of the world. Either we have hope within us or we don't. It is a dimension of the soul and is not essentially dependent on some particular observation of the world or estimate of the situation. It is an orientation of the spirit, an orientation of the heart. It transcends the world that is immediately experienced and is anchored somewhere beyond its horizons. I feel that its roots are in the transcendental, just as the roots of human responsibility are, though of course I can't, unlike Christians, for instance, say anything concrete about the transcendental. An individual may affirm or deny that hope is so rooted, but this does nothing to change my conviction, which is more than a conviction, it is an inner experience. The most convinced materialist and atheist may have more of this genuine, transcendentally rooted inner hope than 10 metaphysicians put together." Havel goes on, "Hope in this deep and powerful sense is not the same as joy that things are going well, or willingness to invest in enterprises that are obviously headed for early success, but rather an ability to work for something because it is good, not just because it stands a chance to succeed. The more unpropitious the situation in which we demonstrate hope, the deeper that hope is. Hope is definitely not the same thing as optimism. It is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something makes sense, regardless of how it turns out. In short, I think that the deepest and most important form of hope, the only one that can keep us above water and urge us to do good works, and the only true source of this breathtaking dimension of the human spirit and its efforts, is something we get, as it were, from elsewhere. It is also this hope above all which gives us the strength to live and continually try new things, even in conditions that seem as hopeless as ours do here and now." Remember that this was written in 1985, not long after Havel had been released from jail, and apart from the glimpse of hope promised by the arrival of Gorbachev, then an unknown quality as leader of the Soviet Union, there was no reason to believe that the communist dictatorships of Central and Eastern Europe would not go on for another 30 or 40 or 70 years. Yet less than 5 years later, communism was in free fall throughout Central and Eastern Europe, and the peaceful Velvet Revolution in Prague was about to propel Havel into the Czech presidency. Havel was truly writing in the darkness before the dawn. Take another great political leader, perhaps the greatest of our age, Nelson Mandela. And have you ever noticed that the two greatest and wisest political leaders and thinkers of the past century have been a brown man and a black man? Mandela, I have been reading recently about the 1963 trial for sabotage, which led to Mandela serving 27 years of a life sentence in a South African jail. He was 46 when he was convicted and 73 when he came out in 1990. His speech in his defense is an extraordinary testament to hope. This was a man who fully expected that he would be sentenced to death, so he must have believed that these would be his last public words. And what they are is a justification of his life as an African leader trying to overthrow the unjust and inhuman system of apartheid. For many years, peacefully, and when all peaceful avenues had been closed with the minimum and most controlled amount of violence. That justification, he made clear, was based on a vision and an ideal. Mandela risked his life for an imagined possibility, a vision of how a deeply unjust, firmly entrenched system of treating millions of people as subhumans could be changed into a just, democratic, and multiracial South Africa. The account of that speech I took from a book entitled Acts of Hope, written by one of America's most distinguished academic lawyers and classicists, John Boyd White. White compares Mandela's act of hope to a similar stand taken nearly 2,500 years earlier by Socrates. The Greek philosopher had been unjustly sentenced to death by a court in Athens for corrupting the young with his ideas. His friend Crito tries to persuade him to escape to another city. He declines, calmly preferring an unjust death because such a death, unlike escape, would not require him to give up the central purpose of his life, to persuade the Athenians to build a community based on justice. His huge success in doing this, despite and perhaps partly because of his death, is shown by the fact that his teachings, as relayed to us by Plato, have provided much of the foundation for political thinking in the Western world ever since. In White's words, this Socratic thinking depends on our being able to imagine ourselves not merely as individuals who happen to be found together, our interests in temporary conflict or harmony, like rats in the maze of life, but as a larger polity, as a city or nation or society that has a moral life and career of its own, of which we can ask the question, is it just? Once again, Socrates' decision to stay in Athens is based on a courageous act of hope or imagined possibility. Despite the almost certain death that awaits him, he will not walk away from the sense of the possibilities of human improvement to which he has devoted his whole life. Boyd White puts it like this: it had been a central part of his life work to turn the Athenians in a certain direction, towards thinking of justice as their ultimate collective concern. And though he is never optimistic about the prospect, it is the imagined possibility that he might succeed upon which he will not turn his back. When I see the genocidal slaughter in Palestine and the grinding First World War-style warfare in Ukraine, I think about what hope is left, what imagined possibilities are left for the ordinary people of those countries. In the most wretched and hopeless places, there are always people who are full of hope, who have hope within them as a dimension of their souls, to use Havel's powerful image. As a journalist, I've been privileged to meet them in Central America, in Ethiopia, in Northern Ireland. I think now about people in countries like Palestine, Syria, Sudan, and Ukraine, countries perhaps written off by our Western world as hopeless, even doomed. Ordinary people doing their best in the face of the kind of poverty and persecution and violence that would drive most of us very quickly to despair. And I marvel at the quality of human hope in the face of such unbelievable adversity. I'm going to finish with a famous Irish poem about hope. As so often, you have to turn to poetry to find the best expression of our deepest human qualities and yearnings. This Seamus Heaney poem is from his verse play, The Cure at Troy, written several years before the Northern Irish peace process got underway. These are his much quoted, but still enormously powerful and prophetic lines about the eve of the end of war in ancient Greece and modern Ireland. Human beings suffer. They torture one another. They get hurt and they get hard. No poem or play or song can fully right a wrong inflicted and endured. The innocent in jails beat on their bars together. A hunger striker's father stands in the graveyard dumb. The police widow in veils faints at the funeral home. History says, don't hope on this side of the grave. But then, once in a lifetime, the longed-for tidal wave of justice can rise up and hope and history rhyme. So hope for a great sea change on the far side of revenge. Believe that a further shore is reachable from here. Believe in miracles and cures and healing wells. Our next hymn is hymn 298, Wake Now My Senses. There are some notices. First of all, warm congratulations to Jen Cummins for becoming a TD in the recent election. It's wonderful to have a TD as a member of our congregation. So congratulations to Jen. We also have a former TD and a former minister, Liz McManus, who's recently today became a... on Saturday, the 14th of December, the Communication Workers Union Brass Band will give a concert in the church. All are welcome. It's a free concert, and please invite friends for a lovely evening. Sunday, the 15th of December, is our service of readings and carols. Do please invite family and friends to this service. It is always a wonderful service. Afterwards, there will be a sale of cakes and crafts in the Damer Hall. We'll also have a raffle. The prize is a Christmas cake, pudding, and a £100 voucher. Funds will go to the Capuchin Centre in Church Street, which provides hot meals and support for anyone in need. We supported this charity last year. The most helpful support we can provide is as follows. The Capuchin Centre provides every child with Christmas pajamas, hat, gloves, and a scarf. And in addition, they receive a gift voucher for Smith's Toy Store for €50. Any or all of these gifts are welcome. If you cannot afford a €50 voucher, we accept vouchers for a smaller amount. However, if you were to spend more than €50, please limit the amount on any one voucher to €50. On Sunday, the 29th of December, we have a service of favorite readings. If you have a reading you would like to share, please contact Bridget. Tea and coffee are served as usual downstairs after the service. Please join us. There are a few copies of December Auscult magazine on the table outside. Please take one. So our last hymn is Come Sing a Song with Me, 346.